Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some new movies. Focus, the return of Will Smith, The Lazarus Effect with the return of Olivia Wilde, and What We Do in the Shadows with the return of the Flight of the Conchords. I'll also be talking about some news, including my reactions to the Oscar ceremony and the winners, and I have some selections from the trailer park, the box office predictions, a listener voicemail, and the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, this is how you can get in touch with me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The news, at least this segment, I'm going to be focusing on the Oscars and who are the big winners, who are the big losers. I know it was last week, but you know, you had my perfectly and totally accurate Oscar predictions last week. Let's talk about whether they were, in fact, 100%. So the big winners of the Oscars, of course, Birdman was a huge winner. It took home Best Picture, which I predicted, and it took home Best Director, which I did not. And it also got a whole bunch of awards. There were significant awards, even though it didn't get the acting awards, and Michael Keaton did not win. And I predicted Michael Keaton to win. A lot of people were predicting Michael Keaton to win, but Eddie Redmayne kind of snaked in and took it away from him. But it's not that Eddie Redmayne didn't deserve the Oscar. He certainly did. He did a fantastic job. And in fact, I say from an acting standpoint, I agree with the Academy on this one. Eddie Redmayne did more of an acting performance than Michael Keaton, even though Michael Keaton was fantastic in Birdman. It was much more of an acting tour de force by Eddie Redmayne. The other big winner of the night was Whiplash, which a lot of people aren't terribly aware of this movie. I even saw a friend of mine who'll remain nameless. He works in the industry. He works in television, not movies, but he works in television. And he even made some comment on his Facebook page of, I've never even heard of this, Whiplash. And I have to say, you know, hey, if you work in the industry, I don't care if you're TV versus movies, you should at least have an awareness of the Best Picture nominees to have a certain level of credibility. But there's a lot of people who had never heard of Whiplash, who didn't know anything about Whiplash, and obviously who had never seen it. Now, this should hopefully shine some light on the film. It comes out on DVD this week. We'll talk about that later in the show. But it's worth checking out because it's a very good movie. But it was a big winner, not just for J.K. Simmons' Best Supporting Actor win, which was pretty obvious. He was going to win that. It was obvious he was going to win, and Patricia Arquette was going to win for Boyhood, and Julianne Moore was going to win for Still Alice. It also got editing and a sound award, and those are important because that shows that it was a real credible movie, that it wasn't just this odd little movie that had one award, gets a little nod to it, and then everything else goes to other people. I mean, it beat out some pretty big contenders, and that's a good thing because it is a smaller movie, and it deserves to have the light shine on it. Now, the big loser of the night was Boyhood. Even though it got a Best Supporting Actress win for Patricia Arquette, a lot of people were predicting it to get Best Picture. A lot of people, I even thought it was going to get Best Director because I think they were going to split. They've been doing that actually recently. Last year, they split. And the year before they split, but that was not the case. And you had, of course, Iñárritu win for Birdman. I mean, aside from other big surprises, there weren't too many. I think a lot of people were expecting How to Train Your Dragon 2 to win Best Animated Film. But, you know, Disney winning Best Animated Film is, I don't think you could ever describe that as a shocker. So it was a pretty predictable show. But the news stories that came up on this, and I was interviewed on the Wall Street Journal about this, were the political speeches. A lot of people had gotten upset about the fact that people were using their time to talk politics. And the most obvious one was Patricia Arquette. She gets up there. She doesn't even do much of a speech. She goes right into the political ramifications of gender inequality, not just in Hollywood, but elsewhere, and unequal pay, and how people need to fight for that. I gotta say, and I've been asked about this on several venues, and I said, you know what? Here's the thing. If you win an Oscar, you get whatever that is, that 30, 45 seconds or so whatever your allotted time is for your speech, you can use it however you want to. You've earned that time. By winning that Oscar, you have earned that 30 or 45 seconds on national TV to say whatever you want. Now, I mean, you could be like Michael Moore, and when he won the Bowling for Columbine, the most famous, probably the most famous example of somebody hijacking their own speech for political gain. And his speech had nothing to do with his movie. And that's kind of one of the things that irked me about his speech. If he was going to give a speech about gun control, I may not agree with what he has to say about gun control, but it's relevant to Bowling for Columbine, which is won the Oscar for. But no, he was talking about the Iraq War and actually didn't set the stage for him to make the biggest movie of his own career, ironically making him one of the biggest war profiteers of that era. But still, it was his speech. It was his time. And Patricia Arquette used her time to give her thoughts. And they were relevant thoughts. Maybe it wasn't relevant to Boyhood, but it certainly was relevant to the Oscars and the Best Supporting Actress category, especially considering the news that came out in the Sony leak about how in American Hustle, Amy Adams and Jennifer Lawrence were paid considerably less than Christian Bale and Bradley Cooper, even though they were Oscar nominees. I mean, this was relevant. There was some connective tissue to her speech. What bothers me is if somebody were to go out and be a presenter, or if Neil Patrick Harris as host took a chance to speak on his pet cause, that's hijacking the show. You know, or like when Common and John Legend were talking about voter inequality, it's directly relatable to the movie they won for, which was Selma. So I didn't think it was that overly political simply because people weren't just using their own pet causes throughout. It was relevant to what they were talking about. The other big complaint I heard about it was, oh, American Sniper didn't win. And, oh, Hollywood just ignored the American people. American Sniper was never going to win. If you thought that American Sniper was going to win Best Picture, or Best Actor. I mean, I'm not saying Bradley Cooper didn't do a good job, but he was going up against the Michael Keaton and Eddie Redmayne. It was their race going into this from the beginning. So he wasn't going to win Best Actor. It wasn't going to win Best Picture. Eastwood wasn't nominated for a Best Directing Oscar. It had the box office, but this has never been a award show about box office. If this were an award show about box office, Star Wars would have won instead of Annie Hall in 1977. Avatar would have beat The Hurt Locker a couple years ago. Return of the King won and Titanic won, but those are the exceptions to the rules, and those were sort of beloved and honored in spite of their box office. No one saying American Sniper should have won because the box office is going to go out on the limb and say that Transformers Age of Extinction should have won because it's one of the highest international grossers of the year with over $1 billion. And going into the Oscars, yeah, American Sniper was up there, but the highest grossing film of the year was Mockingjay Part 1. I don't think there's anybody out there trying to make the case that Mockingjay Part 1 should have even come close to being nominated, let alone winning an Oscar. I'm going to talk a little more news in the next segment, but before we do that, let's move on into the trailer park. One is The Cobbler, which is an Adam Sandler movie. It kind of goes back to sort of a middle school Adam Sandler. I'm not going to say old school because his old school is kind of Billy Madison. The kids type stuff.
I could be anybody I want.
Shop's closed half the time.
Acting all crazy.
We're trying to stop real estate developers from forcing the regular people out.
How did you hear all of this?
Look, I have a special ability to see stuff I shouldn't.
It's a privilege to walk in another man's shoes, but it's also a responsibility. You are a guardian of souls. You are the cobbler.
This looks somewhat sweet. I'm kind of interested in it because it looks like it's trying to recapture stuff he was doing, like when he did Bedtime Stories, or it has a little bit of a feeling of Click, if you remember that movie that came out. Not to say that Adam Sandler's middle level movies were really great, but at least it doesn't look like it's going to be Jack and Jill or Grown Ups or another one of those terrible movies. The next one I want, it isn't really even a trailer. Well, it is a trailer, but it's not for a feature film. It's for Frozen Fever, which is attached to Cinderella, which opens on March 13th as well.
On March 13th.
Come on.
It's time.
It's the perfect day.
Don't touch anything.
For a new Frozen treat.
I'm not eating cake.
Olaf, it's for Anna.
And it's for Anna.
It's clearly Disney trying to get more people in the seats because Cinderella oddly enough, doesn't have the cachet that Frozen has with the modern audience. And little kids don't, they may know who Cinderella is, but when I went trick-or-treating with my kids, I saw a lot more Elsas than I saw Cinderellas. At least it looks like it's at the high level of animation. It doesn't look like a step down as a direct-to-DVD sequel. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about more news and the film What We Do in the Shadows. Na, 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 hey, ya, na. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing on, before we get to the reviews, I want to talk about some more news. Richard Linklater talking about wanting to make a Boyhood sequel. And that's great. Coming to a theater near you in 14 years. This is sort of Richard Linklater style. I think he wants Boyhood to follow the path that he did for the Before, After, Midnight, Sunrise series with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. You may not know what those are. If you don't follow film and you don't follow independent smaller movies, you'll probably have likely never heard of those films. But what he did is, these were movies that he made. He basically got together with Ethan Hawke, who's also in Boyhood, and Julie Delpy, and he shot these. And I don't know how much was hard scripted or if there was some improv, but it was just this relationship with this couple, and it kind of took a very limited approach. It was shot very quickly, whereas Boyhood was shot, he came back and shot like, well, I don't know, however many, like 10 minutes, 15 minutes of it every year. These shows, he would shoot this whole movie and do it over a weekend. And they've done three or four of these. I'm not a big fan. I'm not a big fan of Richard Linklater anyways. I know people who love these films. And I think he wants to see Boyhood do the same thing. The difference is, Before Sunrise, Before Midnight, After Midnight, all those movies, he could just shoot those and he have one and done, and he could then go do another movie. To do a Boyhood sequel, and I've actually heard him talk about this when this came out. He talked about saying he wanted to do, like, up to his first divorce, which is the most depressing way to look at life, I think. This is why I don't like Richard Linklater. I think he has a depressing outlook on life. I would hate to spend time in his brain, because everybody in his films, everybody's divorced and cheating and smoking pot and in awful relationships. And I think people are better than that. And I certainly know I'm better than that. Honestly, a Boyhood movie about my life would be the most boring thing in the world. It'd be like, well, Kevin's, yeah, there he is. He's still on the couch. So I guess my life and my thoughts on some people and just humanity in general, in that ultra-realistic sense, is just a lot less depressing than Richard Linklater. But he's talking about doing a Boyhood sequel. Sure, go ahead. That's great. I don't think it's going to have the same charm that this one did, simply because part of what people talked about was watching the kid grow up. Yeah, the kid will be older. Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette got older in the movie, but not as dramatically as the kid. Another piece of news that kind of dovetails off of what we were talking about last week, Alien 5, which is the new Alien movie directed by Neil Blomkamp, who's directed Chappie, which comes out next week, and he's now moving into doing an Alien movie. A little more detail has come out. He's come out and said that he's basically wanting this to give Ripley an ending. And I like that idea. I don't like it when they take a series and it goes off the rails, and then they go back and they say, well, this is really just a sequel to these movies in the middle. It just becomes confusing, and it's kind of a mess. And my thought being, as a studio and artist, control your own doggone franchise and don't let it go off the rails. And we saw this happen with the Superman movies. You had Superman the movie, Superman 2, and then it really went off the rails with Superman 3, and then Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, is an absolute nightmare. And then you had Superman Returns came in and was like, well, this is really more a sequel to Superman 2, I think, was what it ignores Superman 3 and 4. And I'm going, that just gets confusing. Just reboot the whole thing at that point. Or, like, for example, the Halloween movies. If you watch those, you had Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis. You had 1 and 2, and then 3 was this outlier. And then they did more sequels. They did 4 and 5 and 6. And then 6 was such a mess that they went and did Halloween H2O. And it ignores everything else except for Halloween 1 and 2. And then that just got confusing. And at least with Rob Zombie's Halloween, he just rebooted the whole thing. So it had no bearing on the rest of the franchise. I want to see an ending for Ripley, and that's one of my biggest issues with Alien 3 is that it just kicks out Bishop and Hicks and Newt. It just gets rid of them in the most unceremonious way, in the most depressing way, which makes sense for David Fincher, but it was a bad choice because I want to see what happens to those characters. I just didn't want them to die in pods, which is what happened. So I like the idea. I'm not wild about the retconning, but I'm still curious to see hopefully it'll get him out of South Africa. He's South African. That's if you don't know that he's South African. His movies are very steeped in South African politics and the massive poverty that happens. And even something like Elysium, which takes place in LA, it was basically Johannesburg in LA was how that was visioned. I mean, at least if it's Alien 5, it just gets him off of Earth and it gives him something. He's not stuck with trying to redo District 9 all over again. And the final piece of news also comes from something we talked about last week. Jamie Dornan is apparently not leaving 50 Shades of Grey. So it's come out that he's still involved. And like I said, I can't imagine that they wouldn't have locked them all in for sequels. It still blows my mind that they haven't gotten their you-know-what together to get these going. They should have had this thing going. They should have had the next one ready to go, script done, and ready to go into pre-production as soon as this second trailer hit. This is lagging, and the fact that Universal is dragging its feet reminds me of when Paramount rebooted Friday the 13th in 2009. It did really, really well. Its first weekend had like a 70% drop-off, and then they got away from the franchise. And this one, it looks like that's exactly the same kind of thing they're doing. They're treating it like an old-school sequel as opposed to treating it like a franchise. And this may not work. This may fizzle. And I think that this shows that Universal thought that their eggs were all in that first one, and people lost interest in that first one that they may not go to see the second and third. So we'll see. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The first movie I want to talk about is What We Do in the Shadows. The lives of three vampires living in modern New Zealand are profiled in this fake documentary.
When you get the four vampires in a flat, obviously there's going to be a lot of tension.
We'll do our dishes!
Hello, ladies.
Hi, my name is Nick. I've been a vampire for 2 months.
Vampire! The neighbors can see you flying around. You want to draw attention to this house, hmm?
I've got a whole documentary crew following you around.
This is made by the people who did Flight of the Conchords, which I believe was an HBO show. The biggest name that came out of it was Jamie Clement, who he played the voice of the cockatoo in Rio, the white parrot thingy, and he was like the bad guy in Men in Black 2, and you saw him, he was in Gentleman Bronco. He's this weird actor, but he's very, very funny and very, very talented. This movie is a hoot. It's like The Office with vampires. And the reason I say that's different, found footage hinged on the fact that people videotaped stuff on a camera, and then the camera got lost, and then they could find it, and it was all edited together, and it was not done professionally. I do not like those movies. Mock documentaries, fake documentaries, something like The Office or The Sacrament was a fake documentary. Ty West's The Sacrament from last year. Those all are okay because they're meant to be competently shot. And this one's a documentary crew profiling these vampires. It's very funny. It's not exactly a deep movie, but it has some extremely hilarious moments. It has some great jokes about vampires. It throws the Twilighters under the bus and goes back to the old school gothic vampire, you know, the Nosferatu type vampire. I just recently saw last year, I saw Klaus Kinski in Nosferatu, the Werner Herzog movie, which was from the 70s. This one really feels like they pulled everybody out of that. In fact, one of them looks like Klaus Kinski's character in Nosferatu. And they're different ages. One's like super, like 8,000 years old. One's like 400. One's relatively new. And they all have different perspectives. And it's just sort of how they go about their lives, how they get their victims, and just sort of their interpersonal relationships that are very, very funny. And if you like sort of offbeat humor, if you like non-American humor, I mean, it has that bizarre New Zealand tongue-in-cheek but somewhat dark quality that you'll see in movies like Housebound and Peter Jackson's original Dead Alive. So yeah, What We Do in the Shadows is very funny, and it's a lark. It's like 90 minutes, you're in and you're out, and it has some great deconstruction of the vampire genre and multiple vampire genres, but at the same time, it also works as kind of this weird little character piece. So I gotta say, What We Do in the Shadows rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Focus and the Lazarus Effect. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finally rolling into the movie reviews. We did What We Do in the Shadows, which is a great little movie. If you have a chance to check it out, check it out. Next, we're going to be doing the bigger releases. First up on the docket, we've got Will Smith returning to the box office. Well, I mean, he's been in a couple of movies. He has some smaller parts in it. Like, he played Lucifer in A Winter's Tale. I guess that's a spoiler, but I mean, it's been out for a year. It's on video. He was the weirdest cameo I've ever seen. But his previous film before that, his biggest film before that was After Earth, which was terrible. So bad. Oh, gosh. After Earth was so bad. Starred Jaden Smith. It was a vehicle for his son that was a disaster. And recently it came out because they were leading up to the release of Focus. I saw an interview with him where he really took it hard that After Earth bombed so badly. And I'm like, good. It was a crap movie. It was terrible. And you did it just for your son. How many people can get somebody to spend $100 million to make a movie with your son, with their son as the lead? And he's not that. I mean, oh, it was nepotism on screen. It was terrible. And I'm glad that it hurt you. I'm glad that it hit you hard, Will Smith, because you shouldn't be doing crap like this. You used your box office power to give beyond unfair advantage to your son, who is not a likable actor. And that was his last one. He kind of has had his tail between his legs for the last couple of years. Before that, his last film was Men in Black 3, which it was a worldwide hit, but it wasn't a massive American release. And I think that was a little, that hit him hard. He had been out for a while. He'd been out of the game for a while. And this is him trying to make a comeback. Now, of course, he's also going to be in the Suicide Squad with Margot Robbie, who's also in Focus with him. He's going to be in the Suicide Squad. So he might be starting out fresh. He may, which is good. I think he needs his big, huge, I'm doing $100 million box office opening weekends or with each film. That time for him is over. He is now has to dial it back and just be a regular actor who's trying to get some street cred back. So Focus, he stars as a con man who takes a young woman under his wing and teaches her the business, and they fall in love.
I've been in this game for a really long time. I had what I needed. And then a girl walked in.
I put a spell on you.
I know you're doing something big.
So what about the big con?
You mean the one where we make so much money we all retire?
You see, there's a science to getting people to trust you.
Do we have a deal?
Yes, we have a deal. I cannot believe you lied to me.
You can't believe I lied?
Can't believe
it. Oh, that's so rich for me.
That's what you want to say to me?
Yeah, because you're always lying, Nikki, and now we're dead.
This is the kind of movie that you would have seen coming out in the mid-90s that would have felt like one of his earlier films. I mean, it doesn't feel like any specific, it doesn't feel like Bad Boys or something like that, but it doesn't feel like a movie that Will Smith, the box office legend, is in. This feels like Will Smith, who was the Fresh Prince, who had a hit or two under his belt, would do. You know what I mean? This doesn't feel like a massive movie. And Margot Robbie, she's fine. She's beautiful. She's almost too pretty, actually. She's her biggest challenge in Hollywood going forward is she's so pretty. She's not approachable. It's going to be hard to put her in like the romantic comedy. Like Sandra Bullock, just going on just a raw, I mean, they're all likable. She's very sweet on screen. She's cute. But like Sandra Bullock has this approachable girl next door quality to her when she was doing rom-coms back in the 90s that worked for her. Same thing with Julia Roberts, Reese Witherspoon, name anybody. The most gorgeous women, the like the sizzling hot women, which she is, Margot Robbie is, it's not as easy to make that because she's so unapproachable as gorgeous as she is. Now, the two of them, Will Smith and Margot Robbie, they have a decent enough chemistry, but not perfect chemistry. They're not fantastic. They don't knock it out of the park. They don't sizzle. I know you've seen there's an ad going around where somebody says it sizzles or something like that. They don't sizzle. This is not a movie you would expect to see a powerhouse actor in. You know, it just looks like a run-of-the-mill adult drama from the 90s, and it plays that way. Now, I mean, it's a con man movie, and one of the problems when you get into a movie like a con man movie, anything that they do, whether it's somebody playing poker or whether it's somebody doing a job, they're so good at it that it becomes unbelievable at times. They make the con and their pickpocketing skills for the smaller things, they're just so good that you're like, how did you do that? How did you lift my wallet that's in a hermetically sealed baggie in my underpants? How did you get to my wallet? Oh, you just have to use distraction. I mean, they have such ridiculous moments like that, and they do overdo it. And a movie like this always hinges on a lot of very, very smart people oftentimes making dumb decisions. It gets a little convoluted. It has some twists and turns that are completely and utterly predictable. It's okay, but I don't think I would race out to see it. I mean, this is one that's right on the cusp. I mean, it's at least it's short. It's not like 2.5 hours, and you know, it's like 1 hour and 45 minutes. So it's, but it, and it has some interesting things, but the characters aren't really well developed. I'm going to have to say that Focus kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is The Lazarus Effect. Medical researchers discover a way to bring animals back to life and end up trying it out on one of their own when she dies in an accident.
This whole process started with the Lazarus Serum.
The goal here is simple, to bring someone back from the dead.
About one. In 3, 2, 1.
Zoe, she's been electrocuted. Clear?
I'm not gonna lose her.
You're talking about bringing someone back from the dead.
Did I just die?
What?
It's not Zoe in there.
I went somewhere.
That was a dream.
I am just going to start this off by saying, anyone who knows me, I've talked about this before, one of my favorite subgenres of science fiction and or horror is a story about a group of scientists in a lab doing something that should better humanity and making a couple really bad, colossally terrible decisions and having it go horribly awry and possibly wiping out everybody on the planet. We saw that in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. James Franco's character was trying to get a cure for Alzheimer's and help people out, and he ends up starting the ape apocalypse. You know, there's the movie Splice, one of my favorite movies of, I think it was 2009 or 2011. Splice was a movie, nobody liked it except me, but it was a movie where these people were trying to develop something and it turned into, like, could be the destruction of our species. I love these movies, and I don't know why. The Fly. David Cronenberg's The Fly, and even the original The Fly. But David Cronenberg's The Fly is a guy trying to create teleportation, which would be revolutionary to people. But, you know, of course, he morphs himself into a fly, which is, you know, ultimately a bad thing. I love those kind of movies. I don't know why. They just, I get sucked in. I just eat those things up. And that's essentially what The Lazarus Effect is. Now, it's a very, very standard horror film. It's PG-13, but it doesn't feel like it's been overly sanitized for PG-13. You see movies when you like, and you're like, oh, they're clearly avoiding showing stuff to retain a PG-13 rating. It's not terribly scary. It's slumber party scary stuff. Like, I remember I said this about Ouija. I remember I said this about The Apparition that came out a couple years ago. These are the kind of movies that scare teenage girls at a slumber party. They're not exactly horrifying films, but I find them fun. And the other thing that's neat about it is when the action really hits, it all takes place over the course of one night. And I like that because there are so many bad decisions made by the characters in this movie, but they really don't have time to reflect on them and make the right decision, which works because it has a certain energy to it. And I mean, there's a lot of shaky cam and flashlights, and I think it was originally meant to be a found footage movie because it's about this girl. She's documenting the thing, and she really doesn't need to be there. So I have a feeling it may have had its roots in found footage, but they didn't make it found footage for good, which is a good thing because this would have been terrible as found footage. But it's also kind of neat to watch all these TV actors. You know, you had Olivia Wilde, who was 13 from House, and Mark Duplass is who's in, he's in The League, and you got Danny Glover in this, and he's, of course, in Community. So it's all these TV actors doing this movie. And it's a disposable, interesting enough horror film. Again, very predictable, but I enjoyed it. And like I said, it's one of my favorite types of movies. I'm going to have to say that The Lazarus Effect kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to address the listener voicemail, talk about the box office, and have the world-famous DVD roundup. A Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys at the Movies, wrapping things up with our final segment. We are going to be talking about some listener voicemail, some box office, and some DVDs. We're done with the reviews. That's what you come for. You stay for the gravy. And this is all gravy, this segment. Let's kick things off with a listener voicemail from our good friend Thomas from Seattle.
Hi, Kevin. This is Thomas from Seattle. Hey, I was wondering, is there any like actors or directors that you personally like that have been maybe struggling with their careers that, you know, you would like to see make a comeback? And like, who would those people be? Keep up the good work. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right, Thomas. That's a good question, because there's always people kind of leaving popularity and coming back. And we even talked about Will Smith in an earlier segment about how he kind of dropped off for a couple of years, and now he's trying to regain his star power. And star power doesn't last. I mean, there was a time where Burt Reynolds was the highest box office draw in America. This was like in the late 70s. That seems almost impossible nowadays. Let me throw a couple directors out there. I'd like, and some of them are still working. It's not that they have left completely. It's just they're not doing what I used to like to see them do. The first one is Paul W.S. Anderson. Now, he is, of course, best known for the Resident Evil series, and he did the first Alien vs. Predator movie. Those are not his strongest films. I absolutely loved Event Horizon, which was very, very early in his career. I think it was like a second or third movie. He did Mortal Kombat. And it's not that he's been a great director. He did like Soldier, which wasn't very good. But I'd love to see him do something like Event Horizon again. It's one of my favorite science fiction horror movies. I think it has a lot of neat stuff in it, and it still holds up almost 20 years later. Another director I'd like to see come back is Martin Brest. Not just because of his last name, but because he had such a great career that was completely torpedoed and nuked by Gigli. This is the guy who did Midnight Run and Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, talk about classic films from the 80s. And even though I wasn't a big fan of Scent of a Woman, that was a big movie. So he did some significantly good stuff. And then he did Gigli, and his career was over. He didn't even go like to direct a video. He just disappeared. Gigli killed his spirit and killed his soul. I'd like to see Martin Brest come back and do some more movies. Maybe go back and do something gritty maybe gritty but funny, but something like Midnight Run or Beverly Hills Cop again. I mean, it's been a long enough time. The other director I'd love to see come back, I'm of course picking these obscure directors that not a whole lot of, I mean, Paul W.S. Anderson, a lot of people know, and Martin Brest, a lot of people, of course, remember Beverly Hills Cop, but not a whole lot of people remember that name out of thin air. The other one is another person you've probably never heard of by name, Tom Holland. And again, this goes back to when I grew up in the 80s. This guy did two of the best 80s horror movies out there in terms of pop horror. And those were Fright Night, the original, and Child's Play. I mean, talk about creating an iconic character like Chucky. This is the guy who first brought Chucky to screen. And like Fright Night and Chucky were just a couple of years apart. I'd love to see Tom Holland come back. Now, he is coming back. He's doing a Stephen King adaptation. But, you know, Stephen King, of course, also isn't the box office draw that he used to be. I mean, they did a Good Marriage last year. I remember covering it. And it was just like a VOD title. Not a bad movie, but Stephen King doesn't have the massive powerhouse appeal that he did in the 80s and 90s. With his name on a movie. So those are some directors I'd love to see come back. And of course, they're obscure because, well, they're not well known right now. In terms of actors, let me throw out Tom Atkins first. I love Tom Atkins because he is the quintessential cop who smells like off-brand beer and cigarettes. That is the kind of character he played in the 80s in movies like Halloween 3 and The Fog. And he was in Creepshow. He played the dad in the wraparound story in Creepshow. He was recently in movies, sort of recently, in movies like My Bloody Valentine, the remake. He was also in Drive Angry. He's been in tons of John Carpenter movies. He was in Night of the Creeps. He was in Escape from New York. He played one of the military people trying to get Snake Plissken onto the job. He's a lot of fun. And I'd love to see him come back. I'm a big Tom Atkins fan. And also from Drive Angry, an actor I'd like to see come back. Everybody knows, but his career in feature films is kind of dead. Well, his career in theatrical feature films is dead. And that would be Nicolas Cage. I'd love to see Nicolas Cage come back and do some theatrical films. Because of some bad personal and financial issues he's had, he is just making whatever crap comes out. I mean, it's just direct-to-video, direct-to-video, direct-to-video. And all the movies are really low-rent, terrible films. And nobody's above this sort of thing. You see big-name actors like Sigourney Weaver and like Nicole Kidman showing up in these kind of movies. And you're like, well, wait, these people have real movie careers. They do these movies all the time. You just don't hear about him all that much. But Nicolas Cage, his last big movie that was released was the second Ghost Rider movie, Spirit of Vengeance. And I mean, the Croods, but that, you know, the voice acting takes place so far ahead of the finished product. I mean, I remember when he was box office gold, like in the late 90s and into the 2000s. Remember when he did the National Treasure? I'd love to see National Treasure 3. I'd like to see Nicolas Cage doing big major movies again. I'd love to see him do some more Jerry Bruckheimer stuff. So yeah, Nicolas Cage. I'd like to see Nicolas Cage get a comeback. He will. He will. Eventually he will. He'll star in a Quentin Tarantino movie and get his comeback. Thank you, Thomas from Seattle, for the question. You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, 50 Shades of Grey won the box office again with $22 million, which is not a bad number for February, but it was an almost 74% drop. The box office, I mean, plummeted from week to week. This was a huge drop off compared to like Kingsman, The Secret Service, which came in second with $18 million, had just under a 50% drop off. So it shows how front loaded a movie like 50 Shades of Grey is. And I think that's one of the reasons why Universal is sort of stumbling around trying to figure out what to do with the sequels, because I think they saw the drop off for this. And from what I understand, this is the sexiest of the three stories. I wouldn't be surprised if they're still trying to figure out weighing the money. I mean, internationally, it's doing very well. It's made like $300 million internationally. But it's a question of whether the sequels are going to make as much money if it's dropping off this much weekend to weekend. McFarlane USA won for the new releases at $11 million. And then The Duff was very close behind, just like $200,000 below it. And then Hot Tub Time Machine bombed with $6 million, under $6 million, as it should have, because it was a dumb movie. This week, I'm going to actually say $25 million for Focus, which is not bad for a movie like this in February, an end of February release, but it's terrible for a Will Smith movie. But that's because he's been sort of out of the game for a while. And it's not a known property. It's not a popular adaptation. You know, it's not Men in Black 3 was supposed to do better because it was the third in a big franchise. Focus is an original movie, and it's really just his name on it. And he hasn't been headlining a movie in a while. He certainly hasn't been headlining a movie that wasn't science fiction big type movie. I mean, this is his first big movie. This is his first off movie since, I think, 7 Pounds. So $25 million is not great for the Will Smith name, but it's decent for this movie. And Lazarus Effect's going to be low because it's just a cheap run-of-the-mill horror movie, which I did kind of like. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now it is time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. We have a sort of an Oscar collection going on this week with DVDs and Blu-rays. The first one, the big one of the release, my favorite of all the titles, is Big Hero 6. This is, of course, the Disney animated film. It won Best Animated Film at the Academy Awards last weekend. It's a great fun adventure story that kids can like and adults can like. It's very out there. It's full of adventure and action, but it also has a lot of heart. Check it out. It's also in 3D. Get the 3D Blu-ray. It's fun to watch with the kids. It's really a fantastic film. There's also Whiplash, which won some Oscars this last weekend. Like I said, if you haven't had a chance to see it, check it out. It's definitely worth seeing. It's not esoteric or snooty or anything. It's a good solid character piece. So check out Whiplash when you get a chance. Horrible Bosses 2 was not nominated for any Oscars. Probably didn't need to be. I thought it was funny. It wasn't as good as the first movie, and it doesn't quite hold up upon a second viewing as well, but it's still funny. I mean, it has a lot of funny lines, and I think Jason Bateman, Jason Sudeikis, and Charlie Day do a great job together. Some other selections, we have Beyond the Lights, which was a surprisingly well-done romance about a pop diva music star falling in love with a cop. There's also Watership Down, which is a fantastic animated film, not really for kids, about rabbits, based on Richard Adams' book from, I believe, the 70s. And it's about the politics and interpersonal relationships between these rabbit tribes in the world. It's the Criterion Collection. Criterion always puts out fantastic pieces. Finally, Sons of Anarchy Season 7. I kind of gave up on that show. I, as a friend of mine said, I broke up with that show just because every episode was an hour and a half. But I mean, I know people who just love Sons of Anarchy. So that is out there, plus the entire series. And then finally, the stinker of the week is Dragonheart 3, The Sorcerer's Curse, because, I mean, how long? It's been like 20 years since the first one, and we now got kind of the second sequel, and it's a direct DVD. So, I mean, this has Scorpion King 4 written all over it. That's it. Let's wrap up the show. Next week, we're going to be talking about Unfinished Business, Chappie, and the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.